We have nothing to fear but fear itself. Or is that fearmongers? Next on Principles and Policies. Welcome to today's edition of Principles and Policies. I'm your host, Barry Sheets, the Executive Director of the Institute for Principle Policy. And along with me today is our co-host, the Vice Chairman of the Institute, my fellow analyst, and very good friend, Chuck Michaelis.
Hey, Barry, how are you?
Yeah, that's not a good question to ask me this week.
Yeah.
I am having, I think, I'm having the reaction that I should have probably had immediately when all this thing started taking place. But as I mentioned before we went on air, this week, I think it was the tipping point was the finalization of our primary election that really wasn't.
Right, the stolen election.
Because Tuesday, everybody had to start dumping their stuff in. But then again, the question was, all right, can you vote at the polls? Can you not vote at the polls? So we had conflicting information back and forth, even from the Secretary of State's office. No surprise there, given who our Secretary of State is. but we had a situation, Chuck, where there were a lot of people who were confused. They were confused about the whole idea of why we couldn't have had a primary election on March the 17th, where people went into their polling places, cast their ballots, and those ballots were touted, and we were done with the election by the beginning of April. They didn't understand why April 28th was a final decision date, and you had to basically go through a four-part process in order to vote. You had to first find the website for the Secretary of State in order to request your absentee ballot request. Yeah, that's right. You had to request a request. You had to have it mailed to you. And as we know right now, with all of the layoffs, shutdowns, diversions, and fear-mongering that's going on around this whole coronavirus mess, that the Postal Service is running a bit slow right now, Chuck.
More than a bit.
I know I've mailed out some packages that should have been there in 3 or 4 days, and it's now 2 weeks later, and they're still hung up inside some processing hub somewhere on the East Coast because of their, we're going to hold these for a few days because of corona. Craziness.
It's insane. It is insane, Barry.
First part, you had to request your request.
Yeah.
Second part, you had to receive your request and fill it out. Again, they made it a little bit easier because you could download those requests online.
Right.
The problem is you couldn't re-upload them online to get them to the County Board of Elections or to the Secretary of State's office in order to get your absentee ballot. You had to actually fill this out, print it out, fill it out, then stick it in an envelope, put a stamp on it, find the address of your Board of Elections, which they did have available. You could click through and find your board information. But then you had to drop it in the mail to your County Board of Elections. Why? Because with the fear-mongering, most of the Boards of Elections offices, and if you've looked, many of the courthouses, many of the county administration buildings in most counties are closed or they're so low-staffed that they're not open to the public. So you had to mail it back in through that same postal service that's dragging a little bit and slow. Well, Chuck, I mean, this happened, March 17th was supposed to be the election. It was the following week. It was like March the 24th or 25th when the legislature voted to approve and extend and cut off the date of April the 28th for the election. Well, it wasn't until basically that last week of March, first week of April, that the bill was, put into place and people started realizing what was going on. And you and I talked about this on previous programs.
Right,
most
right.
people didn't even realize what was going on even after it had been out there because they weren't really broadcasting it to any great extent.
Right.
Nor were they sending out absentee ballots to people who are registered voters. You had to basically know that you were a registered voter, know that you hadn't voted yet, and know how to go about finding this information in order to get your ballot. So part two was mail your ballot in. Part three, that was your request for your ballot. Remember, this was not your ballot. Part three was then your County Board of Elections sent you your official ballot, which was your paper ballot. And then part four, you had to fill out the ballot. Then you had to fill out a envelope form with all the same information you had already filled out for the absentee ballot application, including a question we talked about last week. That was tricky. It was like, okay, is the date of the election March 17th, or is it actually April 28th, because the legislature had moved and they had changed the date. So we don't know if which ones, or if all, or if none were counted. But then you had to plop that other into a envelope, and I hope in your county, as they did in my county, Chuck, that was a postage prepaid envelope, outer envelope, to mail it back to the county board of elections. But you're throwing it back in the mail slot and sending on, except if you didn't ask or request your ballot prior to Saturday the 25th, you could walk into the polling place, or that was the original game plan, on the new election day of April the 28th and cast your ballot. Well, then comes to find out that, oh, no, like just the day before. Oh, well, no. That's only if you are medically unable to do something. Basically, you can only go into the polling place and cast a ballot is if you were physically unable to fill out a paper form somewhere else.
Here's what's way wrong with that. My daughter and son-in-law applied for an absentee ballot 10 days before the deadline.
Sure.
They didn't get the ballot in the mail until the 27th.
With the day before the election.
Before the election. And they said, what do we do? And I said, fill it out and take it down to the Board of Elections, because they have a ballot box in the parking lot.
Yeah. Right, to drop them in.
Do not put it in the mail. Now, I don't know if you've caught it or not, but Frank LaRose was essentially livid over the weekend and said the post office has to stop fooling around with these ballot applications.
That's all great and well for him to get all flustered about that, but I got two pieces of news for him. Number one, they're a federal agency, not a state agency,
right.
So he has absolutely no authority to tell them anything. And number two, hey, dudes, if the governor hadn't half shut everything down in the state and everybody was scared to death because of the fear mongering over what's basically turned out to be no worse of a disease than the flu, we wouldn't have had all these major delays with the post office. It didn't like they're fooling around, by and large. I mean, I don't know about your post office, Chuck. I go into my post office. I know my postmaster. I know most of the postal workers in my post office. I talk with them almost on a daily basis. And they're more than willing to basically talk about their frustrations
about the things that
they're required to do now, and et cetera, et cetera. And it's slowing everything down. When you've got you got postal workers unions who were telling their employees not to go to work because they can't guarantee that everybody coming in is going to be wearing a mask. That ends up creating some havoc. You end up having people not working their routes, not working their shifts. You've got things that get backed up. Tell me, how's Frank LaRose going to handle any of that, considering the fact that he's Secretary of State and he has absolutely no control over any of that?
Essentially, it's a defensive position. It's a
pardon my expression, yeah. It's a CYA position.
Yes, and it's a scream in the dark, because essentially everybody knows there's nothing he can do about it, and which means that a whole lot of people's if you go out to the Principled Policy blog, principledpolicy.com, the theme of the last show was using a virus to suppress votes in a primary election.
Oh boy, did we get that in spades? I think.
Yes, you bet we did, and it was deliberate.
You had said where your county was putting out, and of course, I think most counties tried to do that thing where they put a collection box out there.
Right.
But then again, there's a situation is, these are official ballots, and they're supposed to be ballot security. Did you have someone standing there at the box who was an elections official watching it to make sure that it was, things were done correctly, that people weren't able to get a hold of somebody else's ballot that was a part maybe didn't go all the way in there? Like when you go to the post office boxes and you drop it in, you're always supposed to open that door again to make sure it dropped down into the box so that people can't get a hold of what you mailed and take it out of the box.
I'll assume your question is rhetorical, because the answer is absolutely not.
Of course, there was nobody out there watching it because, again, like I mentioned, because of the fear mongering from certain elected officials in our state, most of these places are closed or they're operating on skeleton staffs who can only come in like somebody every other day. Now, speaking of which, and I'll talk about this a little bit later, the legislature may be coming back in next week, but it's going to be on a weird schedule where they're already telling, well, staff from these offices can come in on this day, staff from these other offices on the same floor can come in, can't come in on this day, but can come in on this other day. It's going to be, I think, a very long, ugly spring of a lot of things not getting done because of the way this thing's going on. And of course, you know, instead of just saying, let's open this thing back up, we've got, oh, we're going to have cut dates. But, you know, I'm getting ahead of myself. Let me finish up with this ballot thing, because, again, this election depressed me, Chuck. It really did. It depressed me because I realized that this whole thing was, whether it was an accident or not, it played into the hands of establishment class moneyed interests who could spend lots more money and get their donors to cough up lots more money in that period between March 17th and April 28th for the incumbents or for the favored sons and daughters who were, you know, blessed by the party, powers that be, in order to make sure they won their elections and, you know, everything remained as normal as possible for the establishment. That's what this really ended up coming down to, because, you know, challengers, insurgents, people who were, you know, catching a wave right before the March 17th election. Well, Chuck, I know from many of them that I've talked to, they spent every dime that they had raised going out for the day before and the day of the election. And when you've already put your money into mail, and when you've already put your money into calls that have gone out the day before, and then all of a sudden everybody says, oh, no, well, you know, hey, you got another 5 weeks or 6 weeks of this cycle left. But the only people who are going to get mail sent out are the incumbents, who I can't tell you the number of, I think the number of mailers that I got for our appointed incumbent rep in this district was actually equal to or possibly even more than the number that I got prior to March the 17th, and almost every last one of them, I think one was paid for by his campaign. The rest were paid for and had the indicia of the Ohio Republican Party, who was dumping mail constantly.
Well, welcome to the club.
March 18th and April 28th, because they have the resources to do that. And they were propping up their endorsees, which there's another issue that a lot of people would be upset about. Now, I don't know if Democrats get as upset about this as not, but I know many Republicans do, that it's a primary. That's for the voters to pick who they want the party's standard bearer to be, not for the party insiders to basically hand you one choice or to get behind one horse and dump a bunch of money into them to convince you to have that person be the nominee, so that everything will run along smoothly for the party regulars. But that's what happened. And so I was depressed over that, because we lost a lot of good people, Chuck, on Tuesday. Candace Keller lost her Senate race to George Lang, because George Lang spent tens, if not hundreds of thousands of dollars between March 18th and April 28th in order that Keller didn't have, because, well, you know, most of hers is low-dollar figure folks, and, well, many of those folks were furloughed, unemployed,
right?
Had to shut their businesses down, etc. during this problem. But, you know, the establishment folks, they get money from the medical industry. They get money from the pharmaceutical industry. They get money from the power industries. They get money from the auto dealers industries. The list goes on and on of all of these quote unquote essential businesses, the large scale ones, that were cranking along almost business as usual, and they were still pumping money into the political pump in order to make sure that their guys basically got a major advantage by having this primary delayed as long as it was. So we lost some really good people, Chuck. And honestly, it didn't hit me the day of, but yesterday, the day after the election on Wednesday, we're recording this on Thursday, of course, as usual, but on Wednesday, I really started getting depressed. I started getting angry. I started feeling frustrated. And, well, probably not for the first time, but for the first time where it was deeply emotional to me, I was embarrassed and absolutely ashamed of people in politics. I really, in the day-to-day flip-flop, one hand, other hand, bang, 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 wear a mask, don't wear a mask, it's mandatory. It's starting to look like Romper Room, a complete Keystone Cops kind of feature from the State House, with Governor DeWine not being able to make up his mind, except for the fact that, you know, the buck stops with him. You know, we've heard him say that. Well, you know, okay, well, no, it really doesn't. The buck stops with your health director, Amy Acton, because you're hiding behind her skirts. And you are basically not paying attention to the fact that the data is not showing what you guys came out there at the beginning, you know, second week of March, and started yelling about how 100,000 people were already infected and we were going to have all these deaths. Have we had deaths from coronavirus? Yes, we have, folks. We're somewhere in the neighborhood of 700 or 800. Okay, maybe 900 at this point. I didn't look at today's data numbers yet. But okay, yes, that's true. But I did look at another number today, Chuck, and that's really the other thing that got my Wheaties frosted, as they say. And that was the unemployment numbers. In the 6-week period, which is from the time this whole insanity of I'm the governor and I'm here to tell you how to live your life started, 1.06 million new claims for unemployment. Now, some people say, yeah, that's a lot. It's like, no. Let me put it in perspective for you. We have about 11.2 million people in the state of Ohio, maybe 11.3. Okay? Of that 11 million, about 2 million are children under the age of 18. So let's take those out of the equation. So that leaves us about 9 million people. Well, of that 9 million, Chuck, probably about 3 million of that 9 million are people who are either retired, incapacitated, or unable to work in some way.
Right.
They're the permanent disability class. They're the retirees. They're whatever. So, and I may be lowballing that at 3 million. So let's just go ahead and just rough figures. Now, these are, somebody will be like, well, you're wrong because it's only one at 2.3. I don't care. I'm just making, we're just sketching an example here. 3 million. So that leaves us with about, 6 million people who are adults, who are able to work, and who most likely were working. In 6 weeks, Chuck, 1.06 million of those people had to go file for unemployment. A sixth of the active workforce. That's 18%, folks. That means you look around, that's, if you look at six of your neighbors, at least one of them probably had to file for unemployment if it isn't you that you're looking at in the mirror. There are many who aren't able to file for unemployment, but whose hours have been cut back significantly, whose normal business, because they own their own business, has been significantly curtailed because, A, they can't obtain product, B, they can't, you know, they've been restricted on being able to allow customers in, C, they just basically have been told that you're not essential, which, Chuck, I think that really ultimately is where the sand is rubbing, you know, chafing me very hard. It has never been up to a constitutionally elected government to determine what is and is an essential business. That is a fascist system.
This is something you and I have discussed offline several times. This is the hallmark of a technocracy.
Aha, yes, thank you. Let's throw that term out there because people need to know this term. It's an important term, folks, because we're living it right now.
That's right. We are, and it has been a movement that's been around for about a century. It's had ebbs and flows, but currently we're in a high tide. the technocracy movement started in the early 20th century. And basically, the bottom line is the technocracy movement proposed replacing politicians and business people with scientists and engineers who had the technical expertise to manage the economy. And that is the bottom line. We are sitting here in an era where people are running, attempting to run now government and business policy through social modeling, through medical modeling, through scientific modeling. And the problem is, Barry, the models are proving not just inadequate, they're beyond inadequate. They're flat out wrong. Now, I know a lot of people who are going to hear this who have bought into the whole, oh, you need to go out and read the CDC and the National Institute of Health and the IMHE. I've read all that stuff. Now, have I read it in complete, you know, have I gotten every document they've got and read it in depth? No, I haven't. But what I can see is that all you have to do is look at Amy Acton. Amy Acton is a prime example of someone, a technocrat, someone who thinks that they should be the one who decides policy based on the models that she has bought into. Now, the fact is that Amy Acton has bought into about three or four different models on this COVID-19 virus, because every time she picks one, the numbers are wrong. And they're not wrong in a good way. They're wrong in a bad way for what she wants to see happen. Now, she bought into the idea that there were going to be 3 million people dead in the United States of America from COVID-19 back in...
Well, here we are 8 weeks later, and I think we have maybe a million actual cases, but that's cases that have tested either positive or I think tested found they've had antibodies.
Let's be clear about something. There have been a couple of people said we don't really know what the numbers are. We're starting to get a handle on it, and statistically speaking. There have been a number of studies. Los Angeles County did a study where essentially a huge number of people, like in the millions, were tested for antibodies, assuming that the antibody tests weren't contaminated, which some people are saying they are, which is, I think, nonsense. But in any case, let's take that something like 40-odd% of the people in Los Angeles County were exposed, and the vast, vast, vast majority of them never knew it. Okay. That's what we mean by healthy people. Now, were there carriers? That's not entirely clear, but we'll concede that. But the fact is that if you look at California's infection rate and death rate, it's really, really way lower than it should be. It's way lower than it should be. Why? Well, because those numbers indicate that California is rapidly developing herd immunity. And it's a herd immunity you don't get from a vaccine. It's a herd immunity you get from being in contact with people who have the disease and cause your body, because you've been in contact with it, to create the antibodies.
Yep.
Once you have the antibodies, you have the general immunity for that virus. Now, again, I want to reiterate, I'm not saying it's not dangerous. It is dangerous if you have risk factors. Now, the big claim is coming in. I know people who are perfectly healthy. You don't know for sure if they're perfectly healthy. Virtually everybody that's popping up with this thing, even the ones who are, I was poo-pooing strokes and heart attacks. And after I read a scientific article, I'm not poo-pooing it anymore. Because the COVID-19 virus attaches itself to red blood cells.
Okay.
Which is part of the reason that your oxygen levels go down if you have an active infection, not if you were exposed and didn't catch it and any of that. You just develop the antibodies. But if you have an active infection, in a lot of cases, one of the first symptoms people were talking about and they couldn't figure out was that the tips of their fingers and their toes were turning purple.
Aha.
Well, that's an indicator that the blood is not carrying oxygen. Why isn't it carrying oxygen? Because the COVID-19 is essentially stealing the it's tying up the hemoglobin. So the way your red blood cells work is they contain hemoglobin, which carries oxygen. Well, if the hemoglobin is tied up, you've basically, I heard it described this way, and I thought it was a great description. They said, blood is like a truck, and it's driving around, and it has this payload in the back, and you add stuff to the payload, and it drives it to the destination and dumps off the payload. Okay? Well, yep. if the hemoglobin is tied up, there is no payload. The trucks drive around, and they can't do anything. So they have this virus, which makes them sticky. And when they're sticky, they stick together. So you get blood clots.
Ah, yes.
And sometimes little tiny blood clots that you'll never notice, except that unless they go to your lungs and form lots and lots and lots more tiny little clots that turn into big clots. But there are people losing legs and all kinds of things from this thing. And I can remember, again, being skeptical, but now once I read that article, I said, that makes perfect sense. So there are people with circulatory disorders that don't know it. They have a tendency to form blood clots, and they don't know it. They have a genetic tendency, predisposition to form blood clots, and they don't know it. So there are people in their 30s and 40s who are dying from this thing, but they're dying from heart attacks and strokes. That's why it's not necessarily wrong to count heart attacks and strokes in the statistics of the virus if you can prove they had it. But they're not doing that. The whole point is there are thousands of presumptive cases. Mm-hmm. And by that I mean there's a presumption that they had it, but there's no actual physical proof, and they're being counted in the death statistics. Why are they doing that? I watched about 10 days ago, maybe.
Okay.
One of these briefings that were done at the federal level, one of President Trump's briefings with Birx and Fauci. And Dr. Birx and Dr. Fauci both got up there and essentially defended the idea that they were requiring that people who were presumed to have the virus were counted in the death statistics. It was almost like living in an alternative reality, if you will. Because everybody knows that if you're going to count those statistically and try to make sense out of the numbers after this thing is, even while it's ongoing, but mostly later when you're doing the post-disease calculations, if you've thrown in a bunch of people who are false positives, your numbers are junk. Now, why would they want to do that? People keep asking me, why would they want to do that? Because the models are so badly wrong, which is where I started this little monologue. Amy Acton, a technocrat, was buying into the worst-case models. For instance, from Imperial College in London, that's where a lot of our primary models came from. And the IMHE work was based on the Imperial College work, wherein the researchers at Imperial College came out and said, our numbers are completely wrong. And yet, we stuck with those models.
And for some extent, we're still writing those models.
We're still writing those models.
Most of the things that have been coming out lately, and as a matter of fact, you know, if you today, and I don't necessarily recommend people to do this, but I went over this morning, and that was one of the things, you know, when I talked about being depressed about all this, Chuck, my wife was like, well, that's kind of your job, is you have to, like, kind of keep track on everything and know what's going on and everything else. And so, you know, you're getting hit with all of it. And I'm like, yeah, I get that. And I can't just stop doing that because I have clients that I have to work with. We have to do this program, you know, other things. But there was a very interesting graphic, which it looks like they've taken it down now, on the Dispatch website. Because, oh, no, there it is. There's a video. And I guess the question was asked in yesterday's briefing to Dr. Amy, why are you not reporting recovered coronavirus patients? Well, Chuck, you and I both know the answer to that. Because it doesn't fit the model.
It doesn't fit the model. They have been treating this all along as if it's Ebola. Now, Barry?
Yeah, very similar, yeah.
If Ebola were to break out in the United States of America, these precautions would be wise. I'll be quite honest. I think they would be wise.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Because contact with Ebola, the death rate is gigantically high.
Right.
Gigantically high, and it spreads like wildfire. But this isn't Ebola. This is essentially a modification of the flu, and I'm not making an editorial comment about whether I think it's manufactured or not. I don't want to go there. This is a flu. Whether you like it or not, coronaviruses are flus. All the bad ones, SARS, MERS, I think, I'm trying to think if Ebola is one or not, but all these really bad flus that have high death rates and high virulence rates, and they're all coronavirus. Somebody said, do you remember the Hong Kong flu? And I think you're too young to remember the Hong Kong flu.
Yes, indeed. I am a little young for that. Yes.
Yeah, that's 1968. I remember it well. Again, we were all going to die, and we were all going to the corpses in the streets and the whole thing. And did a lot of people die from that? Yeah, I think about 70,000 in the United States died of the Hong Kong flu. It was bad, and it was a coronavirus. So these things do come along. Coronaviruses are virtually all, what do they call them, zoo? They originate in animals.
Zoonotic?
Something like, yeah, I think that might be it.
Okay.
But they originate in animals and jump species, which does happen. There are a lot of people, the French are basically out there saying, this doesn't look like, this looks laboratory produced. Okay, whatever. Doesn't matter if it's laboratory produced or not. There's a lot of shenanigans that went on in China. We still don't know the truth about China. We don't know the actual number of infections. We don't know the actual number of deaths. And we don't know the actual number of recoveries. And I doubt if we ever will. Thank you, World Health Organization, because the World Health Organization, people are out there criticizing Trump's response to the virus. Oh, you acted too late and blah, 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 blah. I want to point something out. All the media were going on what the World Health Organization was telling them, and up until January or early February, they were telling them it wasn't even transmissible person to person. Do you remember that? Based on the Chinese data.
Yes, I do remember that.
Now, in fact, on my birthday, February 24th, on my birthday, Nancy Pelosi, with every camera in Northern California that she could gather together, was out at Chinatown in San Francisco saying, come join us in Chinatown. It's perfectly safe. Don't be in a panic. This was after what happened. What did Trump do that created this response about, we must, talk up the Chinese and have everything be hunky-dory with China? Do you remember?
Yes, I do.
In response to COVID-19 and what we were beginning to find out, despite the World Health Organization, not because of, and by the way, the World Health Organization is charged with dealing with pandemics. Despite what the World Health Organization was telling us, Trump banned travel to and from China. And they allowed Americans who were stuck in China to come back, but they had to come back into quarantine.
Right.
A 2-week quarantine. Oh my gosh, the left was livid. Until it turned out that Trump was correct in doing that. And if you remember, a couple of days later, he also banned travel to and from virtually every place in Europe except England.
Mm-hmm.
And, the left was just having a cow over this. Why? Well, later we find out Nancy Pelosi's critical of Trump because he allowed Americans to come back and go back into quarantine. Well, this just flies in the face of logic. And, of course, the news media says nothing. But the fact is that Trump was trying to do the right thing with very little knowledge. Now, he had Fauci and Birx, who are involved in the CDC and the NIH and all that stuff. And if you recall, Fauci came out, and he was critical of the president. And if you'll remember, he was making noises like he was going to become a technocrat and see if he couldn't force public policy. And if you'll remember, all Trump had to do to bring him back into the fold was retweet one thing that said that was hashtag fire Fauci.
Yep.
And what did he do? Well, the president's doing a fine job. I would disagree with some things on this. Now, when Governor Kemp in Georgia basically moved to open the state back up on a very broad basis,
yeah,
Trump was critical. Why? Because he's still listening to the experts, even though, and again, this is what people keep telling me, trust the experts, and I'm like, how can I trust people who have been so consistently wrong? Now, if they were off by a percent or two, gosh, that's within the, 5%, that's within the bounds of error in the model. I am a trained scientist. I get that. Nothing is ever like theory, okay? But
right.
These things aren't wrong by a factor of two. They're not wrong by a factor of 10. These numbers aren't wrong by a factor even of 20. In some cases, it's 30 times.
30. Yeah, that's right, folks. 30. They're wrong by a factor of 30.
This means the model is bad.
Mm-hmm.
No other way around this. And we're going to allow technocrats to take over our government like Amy Acton has, who, by the way, was all for, absolutely, we have to stop elective surgeries. Except
for abortion.
Except abortion.
Yeah, let's not forget that.
Now,
And that couldn't have anything to do with the fact that Dr. Acton, before she became the health director, was a grant administrator for the Columbus Foundation and helped write grants for abortion providers, Planned Parenthood.
Yeah, NARAL, Planned Parenthood. Look, this is becoming obvious. We've got Governor Whitmer in Michigan, who we now are now referring to as Governor Half Whitmer.
Yes. I was going to say Governor Whitless.
Yeah. Governor Half Whitmer, who has basically came right out and said in a speech, oh, no, we're not going to ban abortion. That's health care.
No, it's not.
Abortion.
Don't get me even more depressed and angry, Chuck, because that's where we're going to head to with that.
Angry is good.
But
angry is good. Depressed, you need to work on depression, but I get it. Believe me, I've been there, man. I know what you're talking about.
And I am working on it. One of my therapies, well, first of all, my biggest therapeutic was to go back to Scripture and understand that God is sovereignly in control of everything, and that even these things all work together for His purposes, for good, for those who are His children. Even these ridiculous diktats from on high, from someone who basically, when questioned specifically, runs away from the questioning, obfuscates, talks 110 miles an hour trying to get around it, but who is continually now being, and because the media is not completely sycophantic anymore, Chuck. That's been the great thing. If you've been watching any of these days, what they call, the wine with the wine time, the 2 o'clock in the afternoon, where, if you're not having your pajama party or your pizza party, and we'll talk about that in a second, that you're basically chugging a glass of wine while you're listening to the daily dose of dire news coming out of Doc Amy and Governor Mike DeWine. But the press, finally, there are at least two or three members of the media who are finally starting to ask the right questions. They're starting to ask, just like that one, why aren't we reporting recovered numbers to the CDC? Why are we not? Why are you doing this? Why are you not doing this? Where is your data? And it's just, that in one side is just kind of comical to watch them fold like a house of cards whenever somebody presses on the data button. But, I got to realize God's in control of all this. And God, and there's a reason why these people are in the places they are right now. And there's a reason why all these things are coming out. But I also have to be responsible to myself, my family, and to God. And, I guess maybe that was the other piece that landed was, I'm on social media, which is probably a bad idea at this time because it's basically polarized into two camps, Chuck. You have the camp that are, I'm a civil libertarian, this is ridiculous, this is crazy, data, data, data. And then you have the other side, which is the, I want the leaders to tell me what to do because I'm scared.
Yes.
And if they say something, I'm going to do it. And you'd better do it, too. And if you don't, then you hate me. And, and data, data, data on our end, that's basically the old data from the models that are no longer existent. And I see some people going out there trying to proof text scripture in order to fit a storyline that says that, oh, we're not good Christians if we challenge illegitimate authority. That if we say forcing people out of their jobs and forcing them to wear masks all the time and treating them like criminals if they don't is somehow egregious, that we're not being good Christians because we're not loving others like we love ourselves and we're not looking out for our fellow man. If I see much more of that online, Chuck, I'm probably going to come on here.
Oh, yeah, yeah. No, I'm with you on this. It's like, stop twisting the Bible to say what you want it to say.
Right, and I'm not sitting here basically saying I have all the final answers right on what the Bible says, but I am saying that there are a number of examples in Scripture of where, and one of the best examples is Paul. When told, and this gets down to, you know, the discussion we had before we came on air, Chuck, about your church, my church, and a number of other churches, trying to have a discussion, decide, okay, do we reopen back up? You know, many churches voluntarily set aside having corporate worship, you know, face-to-face corporate worship. Now, many of them, like your church, is going online and encourage their membership to all be there online from their homes during Sabbath. Which I think is a fine thing because, you know, we are coming together for the worship of the Lord that way. So I'm not going to be like some who are basically like, you're a coward and you're denying the faith because you won't go and, you know, physically right open your churches up. Because honestly, the first century, there weren't church buildings. The people met together in homes, and if they had technology, they probably could have met in, you know, one or two, the rabbi and a few others in one home and others in other places where they were. I'm sure that Paul and Peter and others, while they were out doing their ministries in Asia Minor and to Greece and to every place else, would have loved to have had a connectivity
right
greater than Paul writing a letter from prison, sending it through a third party to send over to tell Peter, hey, you're doing something wrong here, bud.
You're making a great point in that there's an extreme on the other side.
Yes.
Shut up, open it wide open, and to heck with all the people who are in danger.
Well, and again, you have to be balanced. I know with our congregation, Chuck, 80% of our congregation is in the high risk category.
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah, you're an 80%
older congregation. We have a very, very small congregation. My family, I mean, my kids, and they're all like 16 and up, are the youngest people in the congregation. You know, our pastor is in his 60s. And most of our elders are in their 80s. I'm the only elder besides our pastor who's under 70 years old. Okay?
Yeah.
That's our reality. And many of them have underlying health conditions. We have one younger, you know, man who's the son of one of our elders who's had two strokes before this all started. So we have to be very, very cautious about how we do things. And when we call everybody back together to corporately worship, now, of course, because our small church doesn't have as much technology, basically what we're doing is our pastor's putting his sermons up on our Facebook page, but he's not live streaming anything, so we're actually getting it, and we're getting more because he's putting things like once about every other day, you know, taking a backlog of his sermons and putting them up on our Facebook page, which has been a blessing. It has been a balm of Gilead to my soul. You know, so it has been the online ministry that your church has had. I've watched your pastor a couple times, Pastor Stephen, give some messages. I have gone and watched our friends up in Mifflin, in the Richland area, at Providence Church, Mark Hamilton's church. I've watched their feed. I've had my cousin who goes in Southern Ohio, and he goes to a mainline Presbyterian church, but the mainline Presbyterian church has a pastor who's Reformed. So I dial in and hear some of theirs. And, of course, beautiful part about these is some of these are live-streamed and then they're archived, so you can just go back and watch them during the week.
Yeah,
too,
our stuff.
Which is something you can't do with congregating on a Sunday morning, sitting in the pew, listening to the pastor, and then going home.
Yeah.
You know, you can discuss what they said, but this way, if I wanted to pull it up and say, and stop it for a minute, and then have a talk with my family about that theological point, and then start it back up, it's great.
Yeah, so
I'm really cautious about both the ones who basically say, you know, the government has the right to tell you you can't have worship, because that is a jurisdictional issue. But I'm also careful about the ones who are basically making it a test of faith and orthodoxy. If you don't physically defy the government and open your doors and basically encourage or cajole all your membership to show up, or else they're less than Christian. Those extremes are problematic on both ends. But
again, you
have that other end where you take the scripture itself and you try to use it to justify tyranny, or you use it to excuse your license.
Well, yeah, and that it's in itself is a form of tyranny.
It is, absolutely.
It's the tyranny of my liberty, and you have to comply with my liberty and go along with it, or I'm going to force you to do that. No, look, I want my mother-in-law, who is in her mid-80s, to be able to go out when she needs to. Now, we've warned her a couple of times, don't go out, please, just don't go out yet. It's the time, and she, what does she do? She goes out. I mean, she's sick of being cooped up at home, too. Everybody is, and she's safe about it. I mean, she's washing her hands. She's not wearing a mask, though.
Well, that's her right.
Yeah, that's her right not to do
that. The thing is, each individual should judge for themselves a number of factors. Number one, you know, do you have underlying health issues or comorbidities that could exacerbate the potential of your contracting this disease and that disease being severe if you should contract it? Okay? So, you know, be mindful of that. Secondly, is it a necessity that even in the face of potential danger that way, is it a necessity for you to have to do certain things like go to work in order to pay your bills, in order to have a home so you're not homeless, or to, you know, go out and get food or whatever it might be? You know, you have to weigh those. But you also have to weigh in the situation that, and again, Chuck, this is the thing. I'm not going to voluntarily walk around everywhere I go with a mask on.
No.
You know, I'm just not doing it.
No.
That is my personal choice to make. It doesn't mean that I hate you because you've decided that everybody should wear a mask because you're scared and you fear for your life. Maybe legitimately, maybe not so legitimately.
Right.
You may have been cajoled into a fear mentality. Which, you know, this is why we're talking about all this data that is now coming out and showing that this thing has never been the pandemic that they have talked about it being. It has been pretty much a new, and untested, unexperienced type of disease, but that disease has not been anywhere near as severe as diseases that we regularly and seasonally deal with without these draconian measures. So you know, you have to take that into account. But, you know, I went out yesterday, Chuck. I had to go and take stuff to the post office and talk to my postmaster, etc., and do a few things. I did not wear a mask. When I went into these places, it was a mixed reaction. There were some other people who weren't wearing masks, and they were kind of like, you know, hey, you know, how you doing? There are some people who were wearing masks, and they were quite pleasant. And, you know, like I went to the dollar store, and this older lady probably looked like in her 70s or 80s. She was pushing a cart full of stuff, and she was wearing a mask. I held the door open for her.
Yeah,
I was not wearing a mask.
Yeah.
She was very pleasant. We had a nice little chat conversation about the weather and about, you know, needing to get out and glad that the weather was getting better so that people could get outdoors more. It was great. She didn't look at me with the suspicious eyes or with this accusatory look that I'm somehow threatening her life by not putting a piece of cloth across my face. But then I also got looks from those who had pieces of cloth across their face looking at me like, what do you think you're doing? Don't you know that they've told us we have to do that? And I'm like, well, no, that's not exactly what they've said. And I do still retain my right to determine for myself my health care. And how I'm going to deal with my health. Chuck, I mean, you know, it's not going to be such a long leap because they've already been, you know, making those noises about, you know, the higher risk categories of obesity and diabetes and other things.
Listen,
well, you know, pretty soon they can use this COVID-19 as an excuse to say, Well, just like de Blasio did in New York City before of, well, no soft drink. Or no, that was Bloomberg.
That was Mike Bloomberg,
Mike Bloomberg, yeah, who basically said that you can't have any, like, sweet soft drinks sold in the city over a certain size because of, well,
yeah, no more
obesity and, and diabetes. They could be throwing that out there. They could be throwing out the fact that, well, you can't go and do anything that would possibly put you in danger, like, oh, I don't know,
name some.
They haven't shut it down so far. Like going out on the golf course, because people do get hit by lightning on a golf course, Jack. So, you know, that could be problematic. But, you know, it just, there's a lot of different things that they can use these type of fear mongerings to try to get people, to get people to comply with edicts. And when people don't comply in certain ways, like I'm not complying with the you should be wearing a face mask everywhere you go, than to basically tell everybody else, well, those people want to harm you. They don't care about your health.
No, they don't.
Because they're not getting with the program. I mean, that's kind of what you're hearing coming out of Amy Acton every day on these briefings. And it is irresponsible of her to try to do something like that. It's demagoguery, and it needs to stop.
Yeah. Now, by the way, you can keep from being hit by lightning on a golf course.
Don't grab a hold of anything metal.
No, there's a tried and true method. Always carry a one iron in your bag.
Oh, okay.
Because Lee Trevino was asked that question. With Carson, I think, asked him that question. If you know who Lee Trevino is, he's an older.
Well, I do.
He was struck by lightning, I think, twice on a golf course. One time, devastatingly. I mean, it was really, really a bad one. And he said, Carson said, "Well, what are you going to do about it from now on?" He says, "Carry one iron." Why would you carry it? What difference does that make? And he says, not even God can hit a one iron.
Okay, that's good. I like that.
So that's how he dealt with it. No, you're right, Barry. And listen, what you just did was you just touched on the idea of technocracy.
Yes, back to this.
We'll go back to it, because everything we're talking about goes back to technocrats who want to social engineer. Now, I found a quote from Technocracy Incorporated from 1938. And this was when the movement was really... Now, it isn't real strong as Technocracy Inc. anymore, but it has moved itself into the social fabric. It's there. It's just not called that anymore. Now, listen to this quote. "Technocracy is the science of social engineering, the scientific operation of the entire social mechanism to produce and distribute goods and services to the entire population of this continent. For the first time in human history, it will be done as a scientific technical engineering problem. There will be no place..." Now, this is where it goes into science fiction-y fantasy land. "There will be no place for politics or politicians, finance or financiers, rackets or racketeers. Technocracy states that this method of operating the social mechanism of the North American continent is now mandatory because we have passed from a state of actual scarcity into the present status of potential abundance, in which we are now held to an artificial scarcity forced upon us in order to produce a price system which can distribute goods only by means of a medium of exchange." What does that mean, Barry? It means money. It means there's something wrong with trading money for goods. In other words, technocracy will provide. Okay, going on. "Technocracy states that price and abundance are incompatible. The greater the abundance, the smaller the price. In a real abundance, there can be no price at all. Only by abandoning the interfering price control and substituting a scientific method of production and distribution can an abundance be achieved. Technocracy will distribute by means of a certificate of distribution available to every citizen from birth to death. The technate will encompass the entire American continent from Panama to the North Pole, because the natural resources and the natural boundary of this area make it an independent, self-sustaining geographical unit." Okay, what did you hear in there? Okay, we've got Amy Acton saying what? Her dream is to require the carrying of paperwork certifying a certificate of health and of immunity before you can go back to work. Now, these are baby steps, Barry, but what you heard in there was essentially what technocrats have been trying to do for, well, go back to the Communist Manifesto. It's essentially a technocratic book. This is from each according to his means, to each according to his needs, and basically what was the phrase that they used? The technate will decide, and they will hand out the paperwork from birth to death. Now, it's not a far step from determining whether you'll be born and when you'll die from that.
Right.
Because the technate may say, you are useless, or you are defective, or you have the potential to have this or that, you know, be a criminal. Therefore, we're not giving you your certificate. The same thing's going on with Amy Acton, and it's not just her. But now remember, there's a big dust up now because Andy Brenner's wife essentially said this. Maybe she should say this with a German accent, meaning that it sounds like Nazi talk because it is Nazi talk. It's not just Nazi talk. It's communist talk. It's Islamic dictatorship talk. Any form of totalitarianism, I don't care what the ideology behind it is, this is what they want. You can't travel from place to place unless you have someone who comes up to the window and says, I need to see your papers, please. That's what that comment meant. And the fact that the governor has come out and attacked this representative's wife.
Senator.
When I say representative, it's small r. I didn't mean big r. I should have made that clear. Sure. Senator Brenner's wife. He attacked her for saying this thing. And what's the first thing that comes out? The race card. Oh, Amy Acton's Jewish. Okay, doesn't matter. Doesn't matter.
It does not matter.
That has nothing to do with the argument. The argument is that this is she wants to play totalitarian. And if you're going to play totalitarian and somebody labels you that, it's a fair criticism. It's beyond a fair criticism. Barry, we have technocrats who are working their way in. Gretchen Whitmer, technocrat.
Northam, technocrat.
Yeah.
Tom Wolf, technocrat.
Technocrat.
These are the governors of Virginia, of Pennsylvania. The governor of Maryland, the governor of New Jersey, all of these states.
Yeah, Hogan in Maryland, DeWine in Ohio.
DeWine in Ohio.
All technocrats who want to be able to control your movement and what your business does and all these things. Some places it's worse than others. Newsom in California. What's the guy in Washington who had to drop out of the presidential race? Can't remember his name, and that's why he had to drop out of the presidential race.
Yeah, exactly.
But that being said,
Jay Inslee.
Yeah. All these guys. Look, do some research on technocracy. Now, don't take it to the extreme. I mean, there's some wacky stuff out there on technocrats. But the fact is, they exist. They're in government, and they want to control you.
Yep.
You need to make your own decisions. If you're not infected and dangerous, you need to make your own decisions and have the liberty to do so.
And you should have the liberty to be able to, if you own a business, to decide to open that business up and set your standards for your employees and for your customers.
And for your customers, yep.
And find out, you know, okay, what will your customer base accept and what will they not? I mean, that's just really what it gets down to. If I go to a business, if I go to a business and they tell me I must wear a mask coming into their business, I'll probably find other businesses to do my business at.
To patronize,
because I'm not going to have somebody tell me what I have to do in order to come into their business. So
Yep. Well, guess what, Barry? We're out of time.
We're out of time. Okay.
Yeah. You know what we think. We want to know what you think. www.principledpolicy.com. That's principledpolicy.com. Look at our archives at www.principledpolicy.com. See what we've had to say about COVID-19 since March 14th. We've been talking about this, and I think maybe even before that. So go back to those shows and listen. And please join us again next week for another Principles and Policies.